Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
Brian Brushwood.
I'm not crying. You're crying. The whole world's crying.
Yeah. Crying tears of allergies.
You know who's not crying? It's Mr. Bryce Castillo.
No, I'm great.
Hello, everybody.
Cry by way of comedy.
we just spent 15 minutes before we went live talking about the weird phenomenon of in Austin. It takes a while to develop a sensitivity to what we call locally cedar fever. So for years and years, all these Californians who come in and get cheap real estate don't understand what the problem is. And then one day they just wake up and they've joined the club where 1 month out of the year we pay a great and terrible price to live in Austin.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly made me reconsider moving there, Brian. So
good. We don't want you Californians out here.
Oh yeah, go back to the Chili's on
45th and Lamar. See, that's an Austin joke.
You wouldn't get it. We do things a little different here in Austin.
Well, I'm just gonna move there so I can get your jokes. How do you like that?
Yeah.
I'll leave right before the cedar fever comes. Not a lot's been going on this year. Not a lot of news. So I've had to, you know, dig for some stories. But something we talked about the last episode, which I wanted to explore a little bit more, was there is currently another twist on the whole multi-worlds theory. And this is the idea that, and we talked about this before, that in one sort of idea of physics is that for every possible action a particle could do, where it's a 50-50 probability on a quantum level, both happen and the universe sort of splits into two and keeps splitting and splitting and splitting, right?
And I guess am I right in my mind, this is in the same category as the wave versus particle theory experiment of you take, like, is light a wave or is it a particle? And it seems to act as both, where you have a couple of slits, you shoot light at it, and if it were a wave, then you would get an interference pattern on the other side of the two slits, and we seem to see an interference pattern. But if it was a particle, it would have to either go through one slit or the other. And I might be conflating everything I ever learned in college, but I believe that the surprising counterintuitive conclusion is that it does go through both slits and somehow collapses into where it ends up. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, because that's why you see that interference pattern of looking like a wave had gone through. Yet if you shoot one particle at a time, you still get that wave pattern. And
right.
You're like, well, what's that particle interfering with? Itself.
And so because at the quantum level, it does somehow go through both slits at the same time, the implication of the many worlds theory is for every possible interaction that can happen, because or along with, or the reason that they seem to go through both slits is because we are seeing the splintered reality infinitely. Anything that can happen did happen.
I guess I'm at the limit of my willingness to say yes or no to anything here, because you look at this slit experiment, you're like, wow, that's neat. I have no idea what's going on, and there are a bunch of theories to what it is. But yes, it all stems from trying to explain, like, things that we know should go one way or the other. So it's an interesting theory. The problem with the idea of the multi-worlds theory is that, great, splits off into a new universe. Later, guys, for all I know. Multi-interacting world says, yes, multiple universes, but we can see the effects of the interactions there. That every now and then there might be, you know, I watched a video that was attached to this, and I'm not sure if it was directly about this, but they talked about, like, they have the whole idea of, like, the brain, B-R-A-N-E, sort of theory that you have on this all the universes are sort of on this bigger, larger sort of multiverse thing.
Yeah.
And then in our universe, we see what looks like collisions and stuff. And so in this multi-interacting world theory is the idea that we might be able to do quantum experiments that could actually detect other universes.
Okay, so brain theory I first heard about in The Elegant Universe by Brian Greene. And the idea was, you know, once you get into string theory, you're dealing with, what is it, 12, 13, 14 dimensions or something?
1921, you just write it, come up with a new one, write a new paper.
Right, but and then the idea is that all of our universe exists in, a wavy sci-fi piece of paper, like that's what we're in. But the idea is that possibly the source of the Big Bang was one brain banging into another brain. And because there are only four constants, gravity, electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force, that gravity possibly affects even outside of your brain. So it's possible that you could talk to another reality if you were able to, like a record, fluctuate gravity. Here's a 90s reference. Much like listening to House of Pain at full volume and annoying your neighbors in a different apartment, we could do that with gravity and thereby create conversation between us and a different brain. Landing? Am I right?
You went off the other direction where they were trying to bring it down to maybe a quantum level here, which I'll read. The fizz.org has our interview with Professor Howard Weissman, who's the director of Griffith University Center for Quantum Dynamics. And in a paper, I guess they published this in Physical Review X, they talk about, they bring up that the bullet points are the universe we experience is one of a gigantic number of worlds. Some are almost identical to ours, while most are different. All these worlds are equally real, exist continuously through time, and possess precisely defined properties. All quantum phenomena arise from universal forces of repulsion between nearby similar worlds, which tend to make them more dissimilar. And he goes on to say that the beauty of our approach is that there is just one. If there is just one world, it reduces it to reduces our world to Newtonian mechanics. While if there's a gigantic number of worlds, it reproduces quantum mechanics. So he's saying that quantum mechanics itself is sort of proof of this. And he goes on to say that they think there might be able to do experiments they could do to try to detect the difference to this.
Hold on. Okay, sorry. Feed that to me again, Egon. If there's only one universe, then Newtonian physics is all the physics you need. But it's only in a many universes paradigm that you even need quantum mechanics.
That is the bullet point.
Okay.
He says, all quantum phenomena arise from a universal force of repulsion between nearby, i.e. similar, worlds, which tends to make them more dissimilar. The many worlds are even create extraordinary possibility of testing for the existence of other worlds. The quote, the beauty of our approach is if there is just one world, our theory The beauty of our approach is that if there is just one world, our theory reduces to Newtonian mechanics, while if there is a gigantic number of worlds, it reproduces quantum mechanics. So I don't know what that means. But
I guess it means
going on to say the implications are for like understanding chemical reactions, drug discovery, et cetera. So
I think that line about Newtonian versus quantum result probably means if we're able to do some experiment that interacts with multiple worlds, that we would not necessarily always get the same result. If we always got the same result, then it seems like it doesn't seem as much evidence as if the results differed every time to a strict experiment that we are actually interacting with other worlds. Is that a very broad abstract understanding?
I think that's as good as explanation.
I think pool is on the brain because we just shot a pool episode. But I guess what you're saying, Bryce, is imagine you racked a bunch of pool balls and break, and every single ball went into every hole, and then you re-racked it, and then you
did it again.
And then the exact same thing happened. And then like at some point, you know, the 8,000th time you get the same result, you realize, oh, well, this is very clearly, there's only one way this pool game can go, and this is it. The mere fact that you get, you know, so much variability or whatever implies that, okay, there's more afoot than just, you know, you this one linear path.
Yeah. Assuming that this is a result where you can get variable results, or if it's an experiment where we expect the results to be different, you know, I have a fine arts degree. I don't have a quantum mechanics degree.
Justin very wisely is sitting back while the other three monkeys are poking the monolith with a stick.
I'll tag in as soon as I understand literally anything that's going on.
And I think that's I bring this stuff up because it's fun to think. I like to think about this stuff because I know people way smarter than me who understand this are having a very interesting debate about something that it's kind of cool to go like, oh, cool. Multiple dimensions. Yay. You know, other than that, I'm like, I don't know. You know, and it's funny because I'll get everything I got Twitter or somebody email me and somebody will try to explain it. And I'm like, you know, less than you realize. This stuff is just weird. It's weird. I think in Sean Carroll's new book, he talks about this, addresses it. And there's many criticisms of multi-worlds theory. It's been around. I think Hugh Everett came up with this years ago, and it's a neat idea, just the idea of the reality of there being other universes and stuff. And I loved this thing, the idea that they're maybe not so isolated that we could find somehow evidence of that, which the sci-fi brain goes to like, man, what if we could just get radio from another universe?
I don't know. I worry a bit about that. That smells a little bit like faster than light travel. Like once, if you have faster than light travel, it sort of breaks causality. And that's what I worry about. If information can transfer from one universe to another.
Ryan, just see faster than light travel here.
I don't know how much we want to go into it, but I worry that getting information from another world in the mini world scenario feels to me much like, remember there was that experiment where the results seemed to indicate faster than light travel, and the immediate discussion went to, okay, you can't have a universe with causality if you can somehow go faster than the speed of light. And so if information could travel from another world, then that feels certainly spooky, weird stuff, but also that seems like it's in a similar mental bucket in my mind.
Well, as speaking as a former cruise ship magician, Brian, in my expertise, I don't think there's anything about this that would break the laws of causality, because causality literally has to do with the idea of kind of interfering with the idea of where something came from or started from, or in sort of a very, you know, very dumb sort of thumbnail description of that. And we had the problem too, because like when there was this stuff, oh, faster than light sort of stuff, was a lot of it was people were talking about the wave and not the information. People kind of like, and the best explanation I had was like, imagine you have a spotlight, you shine it in the sky and you flash it from the, you know, from the sun to the moon, and 2 seconds it takes that beam of light to go from one spot to the other. And if you're on the sun and the moon, it feels like that beam just went by, just hit you, but it's not the same photons, you know, it's the wave, not the actual particles itself. But that's just, it trips us up and it gets very complicated. But as far as, yes, there was some other stuff like, oh, maybe there is something faster. You know, some of the times those theories come out, they're like, yes, because we figured out a different way things work that won't break causality. Because that's every time somebody comes up with one of those theories, I got to say, and this is why it doesn't break causality. I think that we've seen some papers that have suggested that like part of the shape of the universe may itself be because of the impact with other universes and collisions and stuff. And so that would imply like, no, there's no problem. You know, you can have information go back and forth in theory.
I guess. I think you actually set up a really good framework for why I suspect it can't happen. So in our universe, if we made a Dyson sphere around our sun and then blinked out a Morse code message to the universe that said, watch weird things on Monday, there would be some point that we would decide to run the message. And if the mini worlds thing is true, there would be another universe where we either did it earlier or did it later. But in our universe, that message, that information could not possibly reach Alpha Centauri until it passed the however many light years it takes to get over there. But if over at Alpha Centauri they were able to hear the message in the universe where it's played a bit earlier, then that's the faster than information traveling faster than the speed of light situation, I guess, is kind of floating in my mind.
But it's not their information, though. Remember, it is a you have two clocks on the same clock factory.
Yeah.
You know, and so the idea is that, yeah, it could be very similar, but remember, it's not our, because in our universe would be subtly different than that one. And so, you know, we may have a tremendous amount of similarities there, but
I forget
you may have.
I forget which science fiction book it was I read, but that was how the author solved the problem of warp speed. Is he said, like, eventually we figured out that every time you warp, you're actually leaving your universe and just ending up in a very, 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 very similar universe that is not the same universe. And it is Old Man's War. Yeah.
Yeah, that's one great book. That's one approach. One other thing is the idea of you could use it for time travel, and the idea that you just go into a universe almost identical to yours that was started a few seconds later, or you just keep going down a train of, you know, universes that were just split femtoseconds apart, but you go through, you know, trillions and trillions of those, and eventually you arrive at one that's like 15 minutes ago. It's exactly like yours, but it's not, and so the rules of causality don't apply.
There was also a Pierce Anthony book in the 60s before he started writing about having sex with children. It was really weird. But they faster than light traveled far enough away that they just turned a telescope on Earth and watched, ancient Romans walking around, which I always thought was a crazy idea. The idea that theoretically you just straight up could see, although I assume that there would be enough distortion, but theoretically, I guess you could do that if you got far enough out immediately.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we're doing now. Every time we look through a telescope, we look at something. You know, we didn't talk about this last week, but there's been a lot of excitement over Betelgeuse, or Betelgeuse, or however you want to pronounce it, the star, which has its fluctuation has actually declined tremendously, and some people think this thing's about to go nova. And Betelgeuse going nova would be a very big event in our sky. It would be very bright, like as bright as the moon. It would last for a while. It would be very, very, won't hurt us, but it would be a significant event. Now, the time frame from which this could go nova could be anywhere from right now to a couple thousand years. And the thing is that, you know, in some scenarios, it already happened.
Yeah.
Just because if you were like, we are relative to where it is in our vantage point. And so it could have already happened. And we're Europe waiting to get the hot new HBO show.
It's 642 light years from Earth. So if it happened, you know, if it happened 500 years ago, you know, we could, you know, 142 years from now, we'd find out. So
we're like some Eastern communist bloc country waiting for blue jeans to make their way. Yeah.
I believe Betelgeuse, if I remember correctly, is so large of a star. It's one of, I think, four stars in the entire sky that does not appear as a single point of light, but instead, with a good enough telescope, you see it as a disk.
Yeah, it's like its size is like from like our sun to like Earth or something crazy like that. Because that's, you know, the later stages is after a star starts to burn off a lot of its fuel, it becomes less dense and starts to expand, and it becomes this big kind of cloud, which will happen to our sun at some point. Just think about this. Where we're sitting right now, at some point, we'll be in the sun.
Yeah.
You might as well be walking on the sun. It's filled.
Yeah. Space is weird.
Here's a question for you. Sooner or later, something's going to get us. And by us, I mean planet Earth. Do you want to be, if you could just straight up choose, do you want to be part of the last generation of humans? Like, let's say a genie showed up and said, hey, you can pick any time to live in the entire history of mankind. Spoiler alert, it ends with a gamma burst of radiation and like a neutron bomb, just everybody drops dead. Do you want to live in the time so where you get to see the end, or do you want to die right before it, or where do you want to be?
Nope. The only way I want to live through that is if I can actually live through that and I like upload my consciousness that I could be microwaved at some point. I have no interest in being there at the end to see the end unless I can tell somebody about the end many, many, many millennia later because I'm able to live through it. Like, I'm a history buff. I enjoy understanding the flashpoints of history, and I can be fascinated by what people would think of in those moments, but little to no interest of actually sacrificing my life for it.
Bryce?
Ditto. I think I would not want to be in an apocalypse.
Bold choice, Bryce.
Let's say you're like, oh, like, would you like to be? I went to and toured Rome, right? We were in Italy last year, and so we toured Rome. We're going through all these places that, throughout the history of Rome, were you know, various, you know, different things. And it's like, oh, well, here's like all these elements of the fall of Rome, and they're like, oh, picture yourself in there. And I'm like, yeah, but also, can we just like rewind like a couple years where it was just like hanging out and drinking wine and orgies and stuff? Like, yeah, that part better. Yeah. That's better than the lawless barbarians rolling through.
I get enough existential dread here in 2020. I think I will be passing on.
Yeah, it'd be like you're on Pompeii and you're like, man, I think Vesuvius is really gonna go this time. And you're like, all right, hey guys, well, it's gonna go. Let's all head to the airport. Oh, we haven't invented airports yet. What? Okay, let's get on our motorboats. No, we don't have motorboats.
We don't have motors.
What? This sucks. What happened? And I would hate to be in that civilization because I would hate to think that far off into the future, that civilization had no options. I would be super depressed.
Well, and think about
how... And then you're going to screw it up. Everybody thinks they're going to be the person in the first 5 minutes of the movie where the civilization is destroyed and they're like, go... Be the best of us to Kal-El or something like that. But no, you're going to be like, hey, I want to go get some cheese.
Bah! Yeah, Kryptonian number 433 falling down the ice crevice.
I'm going to make the last tweet ever.
I love that, like the extended opening of the original Superman movie, you know, with the destruction of Krypton.
You know, yeah, remind me of it. Is this the one that they use the audio where it's like, for I so loved the earth that I sent my only begotten son?
Well, I mean, the original one. So, like, when you're watching Krypton destroy and they're like all the like ice, their ice civilization is falling apart and people are just falling down infinite crevices and stuff. And it's just this, you know, there's utopian world, which is very sterile, very cold looking, yet, you know, it's just that extended disaster scene. Which you kind of forget, like in the longer cut of Superman. It's just, man, yeah, he came out of some serious tragedy there. But
yeah, whatever. He was just a baby. He didn't know what he was doing.
Well, that was the Kryptonian story is sort of tragic because, like, in the Superman, let's go into Superman for a while, is the idea that, like, Krypton had gone off, colonized the galaxy. They'd been these great explorers. And then they're like, man, nothing to see here. Let's all go back to our doomed world. And they all die, except for one kid.
Meanwhile, they have the technology to have apparently infinite space in a phantom zone that they send their trash to the humans.
All right, we're going to punish you. We're going to put you into this safe room that will allow you to endure any natural disaster.
That's right. You're in trouble now. You're going to have to survive the apocalypse. I'm sorry. We all get to die. It's going to be awesome. You guys have to live. And even worse, you're going to end up on a planet where you'll be gods. Sorry. Bad news.
Hi, it's me, Steve Krypton. Hey, what do you say we make our own Phantom Zone, but we live there instead of dying?
Out of order.
I don't know. That sounds like some Phantom Zone talk, if you ask me.
Some Zod talk, if you ask me.
like, oh, look at Steve, trash lover over here. Oh, Steve's a trash man. Trash man. Trash man.
That sounds like something Zod would want us to do. Want us to go into the Phantom Zone. But no, we're going to punish him by putting Zod and his friends in there.
Oh, God. I'll tell you what. You can go into the Phantom Zone of Pleasure if you support us at patreon.com/weirdthings. Folks, send your money to us.
You know? The Phantom Zone of Pleasure sounds like a Vegas brothel where they only blow air at you.
Yeah, it's just an empty room with a Kleenex box and, like, you know, some techno music playing.
Head on over there right now. Kick us some cash. We love it. We love you. Patreon.com/weirdthing.
Maybe like a Maxim magazine on the counter or something.
Shout out to everybody in Vegas for CES now. We got we're boots on the ground. Sarah Lane of Daily Tech News Show got Advil delivered to her room via a robot today. What?
Is that a literal scene from the movie Ice Pirates where a robot is walking around offering drugs and cocaine and says it accepts currencies of all variety, including water?
All I know is that I immediately snitch tweeted Andrew Yang so he could just put it in his ledger.
Have you guys, here we go. I've seen videos of these where at some hotels they have a robot come to your door and bring you like convenience store goods.
Some guy with a robot sex fetish gets very excited. Well, come on in.
And so you open up the head. This guy got some Greek yogurt, and it comes with a spoon and a napkin.
See, what I don't like about this robot is there's no awkward conversation about where you want it delivered, and it doesn't barge into your room, and it doesn't, you know, create awkward eye contact with judging eyes about whether or not you're still in bed at 3 p.m. Sorry, Steve.
Yeah.
Too cute?
It even makes droid sounds.
Yeah, it makes little Star Wars droid sounds.
Bye, buddy. Come back soon.
It's it looks just like a tall Roomba.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, no lie, if it could microwave pizzas, they would be the greatest thing. Nothing sucks worse than like getting done with a gig like too late for room service, and like you're in the middle of a place where it's not like a Postmates area, or they're like, oh no, we have like one menu for a pizzeria and it closes in 5 seconds or whatever. Like if it could just be infinite microwavable like food at all hours of the night, that might be the greatest hotel technology ever invented.
So we're watching this robot right now that's got gigantic googly eyes. But what's funny is it's as though the Terminator is trying to thinly veil itself, because like the moment you picture those googly eyes, it looks like Maximilian from the Black Hole, man. That thing is a killing machine that they're like, can we put some googly eyes on it at least? Something about it.
So this is a grocery. This is a
red aisle.
So those are like grocery store robots that they have to just keep an eye out for spills and messes.
They're called teenagers, Brett.
That's right.
I'm particularly enthusiastic about this. I mean, there will be a lot of displacement to people who deliver stuff in many cases. But as a guy that gets frustrated when I'm like, the delivery person couldn't bother to call you and they just dropped it off the street or sent it back. You know, a robot that waits patiently for me to go pick up my package. Sounds great.
That'd be great. I'm shocked. Two things that I am surprised at that has not been taken advantage of with technology. Number one, ordering food at a restaurant from your phone, especially for like sports bars or something like that, where it's like four items that you ever want, right? You just be able to put that into the kitchen and just have a runner come out and do it. And number two, just full-on robot bartenders. I know that there are a few very elaborate ones in Vegas now, and there are certainly some, you scan a tap or something and you pour your own beer. But it kind of feels like we're at a point with restaurant tech where that should be more widespread or will eventually be very widespread.
So here's the thing to consider with the robot bar. Entirely easy to do. We're watching robots do this. These are like some pick and place robots doing this. You know, we've had serve yourself drink fountains. There is the idea that the bartender is also supposed to make sure that, you know, who's drinking isn't drinking too much and you know, that they're supposed to monitor. It's like cigarette vending machines. You get into that issue.
Well, sure. But I mean, theoretically, if you were scanning in an account, you're effectively creating an account with your ID, you would have more of a stringent look on whether or not you are getting overserved, because the robot doesn't care that you're a regular. Like it's just going to give you, you know, whatever the height and weight on your ID versus the booze that you're allowed to drink.
Well, hypothetically, again, getting into the gray, if I'm buying a round of drinks for my friends versus buying a round of drinks for myself.
Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess that, but that's the thing that to me, I mean, obviously it's a tremendous amount of overhead. I guess the answer to my question is, restaurants are risky businesses to begin with. Overhead is always a massive problem. So being the place that spends all your, you know, tremendous amount of money on a robot bar may or may not be a win, you know, with the clientele.
This is an interesting idea. The idea of a post or sort of a clear for everything, where it's like you biometrically are verified as you and you are known to be of a certain age. Then I guess we already do that with currency to some extent. I don't know if I've ever paid using a fingerprint, but certainly we pay with our phone, which is on us. I guess you could also, you know that somebody's of a certain age. I guess we do credit card verification for content that is deemed over 18. How do you think authentication works as you know, when you're buying booze in the future?
I think that will be the regulatory issues that we'll do with it. But I would say that one of the reasons that we haven't seen a big push towards it is that alcohol is the highest margin. You make the most amount of money out of booze. So if you're going to put a human somewhere in a restaurant, it'll be the person handling and selling the booze. But that being said, is like we just saw that robot bartender, and anything you can automate will be automated. So, I think it's going to be like a regulatory thing. It's going to kind of like states are going to say, it's like, you know, we've been able to sell cigarettes and stuff and bottles of booze and stuff. We could have beer vending machines, but we don't, because state laws and stuff are pretty specific about how you make sure who's buying and who isn't, you know?
Speaking of cigarettes and digression off the robots for a second, should it have been a bigger story that we raised the age of cigarettes from 18 to 21? Like, cause I kind of feel like that sort of came and went when I
knew that was a campaign. I did not know that it became the law of the land.
Yeah. It was, this past week or so.
I think it should have been a bigger story, but here's the weird part is, smoking as a fashion is so out of favor that I guess it's not perceived as much of anything. I don't know. I agree. It should have been a bigger story for sure.
Yeah. A massive industry. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of complications, but almost certainly the reason why that they raised the age to 21 was so now they can become a larger part of the culture, because now they're going to be able to advertise in places theoretically that they wouldn't be able to before, when 18 is obviously a place where, you know, kids are still in school at 18.
Yeah, it does feel really weird. I think it's called a regulatory capture, when you use the force of law to put yourself in an advantageous position to dominate a market. And we're weirdly seeing that in Juul. Juul right now, the vape stuff, is they're the ones who are funding all of this push to make the minimum age 21 for vaping as well, because they know that getting out in front of it, they'll be able to make it harder for other competitors to enter the market, because they're the ones who have already established themselves as the preferred brand during the most marketing sensitive years of everybody who vapes. And
Is that why it is, or they just want to get in the uncertainty to it because of just they'd rather come out with a law that says let's put 21 and be pushed this earlier on than later wait for something? Because there's been the bigger push towards trying to eliminate vaping, was problematic. And that was her bigger fear, was the tobacco companies were trying to push for that.
Even that, though, like all of those anti-smoking campaigns are funded by the tobacco companies. And especially in Juul's case, like all of the, whatever the, I don't know if it's the Truth Organization or whatever, but they are always specifically mentioning Juul. And I'm like, man, this is my cynical marketing brain. If what you want is to have your cake and eat it too, seems like a great idea is to spend a lot of money to tell a lot of teenagers why they must wait just 4 more years before their sweet, sweet use of Juul. And always make sure to use the word Juul and make sure it's marketed at teenagers.
That I thought that advertising came from a settlement against the traditional tobacco
companies.
Juul
but
Juul.
Correct. And sure. As is the nature of all settlements, it was an agreement that both sides thought was a pretty good deal. And they were they did it, and now they spend money. And now, weirdly, we have advertising money dedicated to raising awareness of both cigarettes and vaping to teenagers, which perversely to me only would seem to increase the likelihood that they would. It's just like all the anti, like there are ads in Texas that 90% of the billboard just says the word marijuana. And then like 2% of the billboard says, it's not cool, bro. like at the end of the day, all you're doing is raising awareness. That's how I learned everything I know about drugs, is from all of the money spent essentially advertising the various drugs and educating me so I knew which ones were hallucinogens, which ones were uppers, which ones were downers.
I guess at that point, though, you have to find the line between deliberate, you know, black ops marketing, right, where you are advertising against something so you can bring awareness to something, or just the feckless, stupid nature of PSA.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm confused, because like up until like last year, Juul was not even a part of the traditional cigarette industry. It was their direct competition to them. So I was trying to figure out, why would the Truth ads want to promote their competition versus, unless this is like a recent development since they got bought.
I know that I saw an entire booth and a lot of effort at VidCon, a teenage-oriented thing that all of these anti-vaping things that looked an awful lot like, you know, you had booth babes talking about Juul a lot. And granted, it was all under the auspices of, whatever you do, don't enjoy the sweet release of menthol Juul until you're 21. Whatever you do, we're out to stop teenage vaping, and we're going to all the teenagers and spending all the money to tell them about how great Juul will be for responsible use after they're 21.
Now, just to take two, sorry, Bryce, did you have information?
Juul is owned by Altria, which is formerly Philip Morris.
Yeah, that was last year, but they're 35% owner, not total owner. So
sure.
Two steps back, I do think that all of these products at this point are understanding that in a digital world where things spread so much faster and in such tighter communities than they ever have before, the idea of having it be an 18 and up product is not interesting to either the vapes or tobacco. Like these are pushes from within the industries to say, hey, if being a 21 and up product means we can advertise more directly, means that we can avoid getting into regulatory headaches, then that's something that we want to do. We want to be freer to operate because we will be free of at least more so of the kids who will think about the kids kind of argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where do we feel the science is right now, though? Like, is vaping been a net gain in the war against smoking?
Oh, I think it's yes. I think there's no question about that. I think I forgot. I think it's what, 300,000 deaths per year are attributable to, or how, Bryce, if you could find me the number. I remember it being so many deaths per year attributable to smoking that you had to count it in numbers of hundreds or thousands of 9/11s every single year to smoking, compared to, I believe the number is at 55 on vaping. Which and most of those have been black market.
The CDC says more than 480 deaths annually. I don't think the CDC measures it in 9/11.
For 480,000, yeah, that's right.
You could choose to use another.
So about 150, 200 9/11s every year.
I like to imagine it that some whatever bespectacled boffin from the FDA trundles on up to the podium and says, "We are very proud to announce that we have gotten cigarette deaths to only 3 9/11s
per month." Anyway,
I the popcorn lung thing. I do not know enough of the science to say anything definitively. Period. Close. Doc. Open new doc. But as a gas bag on the internet, it sure seems like we're covering it like the summer shark. Like that literally anybody who coughs the wrong way is going to get covered like all the oncoming disease of vaping, where it's like the science is fairly clear on cigarettes and specifically the additives. And the tar is harmful to your lungs. And while I think that there's still more that we can understand about smoking, vaping seems like a cleaner alternative.
And also
find the weirdo aftermarket eBay. Yeah. You know, that was the problem he had. There was like, oh, these vaping illnesses, and you find out people are buying these very weird, strange concoctions, and
yeah, it's the vitamin E oil is used to cut the intensity of the ingredients, so you're able to get more juice out of it without reducing the consistency. And so, turns out that sucking vitamin E into your lungs, bad idea.
Well, and that's the thing is, everyone I've known that's you know gotten off cigarettes because of vaping. Part of that thing, at least initially, was to go through the wide universe of flavors that you can get. Like, because they don't sell different flavored cigarettes by and large. Each cigarette has its own variety of what it tastes like, and people have their favorites. But with vaping, it's a little cheaper, it's a little easier, and there's a tremendous universe of flavors. And that's the problem, is that now those are being cut down because, that would appeal to a child would want a cotton candy vape.
That's the funny part is everybody who says that vaping is a gateway drug is 100% correct. They're just wrong about which direction the gateway goes, because it seems to be an extremely attractive and important way for people to get off the certainty of death from cigarettes and instead move to the extremely likelihood of living a healthier, better lifestyle that involves vaping.
Yeah, I don't know a single person that was like, man, I think I'll pick up vaping. You know what? I'm going to go to cigarettes now. I'm sure it's happened, but it's never been. Everybody I know who vapes was a former smoker. Yeah. So. But,
and also, yeah, and think about how seductive it is. You get or you used to get, I guess now they got bans that are being put in place. But it used to be like cigarettes, you got one, two flavors. That's it. So it's like, why don't you join the universe of flavors over at vaping? That will seduce you away from cigarettes. Well, we can't have that. Let's make that bad, too.
Although, I mean, I do see that, like, I do know anecdotally of people who are like, oh, yeah, I tried somebody's vape pen or whatever, younger people like this. So I would believe that probably that the vaping may present itself as a softer, sort of easier sort of thing that might introduce more people into that. I'm just speaking anecdotally.
I think that there's certainly a concern that kids are getting, because kids – you know, in high schools, apparently, Juul is very popular. Vapes are very popular. And so there is a generation for whom the new smoking, the way to signal that you are more adult than your peers, right, or you are a super cool rebel, is now vaping and not smoking. So if that's the case, then, yeah, you should be aware of it. But, like, it kind of seemed like we won. Right, like if there's a whole generation of kids that are vaping and not smoking, it seems like a net gain if you look at it from a large timeline.
I 100% agree, and the weird part is, and I'm thinking about this a lot because we just re-listened to The Righteous Mind, and now I'm listening to The Coddling of the American Mind. I forget what it is, Jonathan Haidt's newer one. But while almost all the negative aspects of cigarette smoking have been reduced or eliminated, the moral sense of corruption, the idea that it still looks so much like you're a poor person smoking is so judgmental, and I hate it. It's a purity aesthetic, and it doesn't matter. They're grasping at straws to justify. Jonathan Haidt talks about the idea of a human rider on the back of an elephant. A lot of the decisions that are being made about where we're going are being made by the elephant, and the human is justifying acting like they're the one who decided all that. A lot of our moral reactions to things happen completely instinctually, and then we come up with reasons or evidence after the fact to justify it. And that's very much what we're seeing with vaping. It's like, at the end of the day, you just don't like the fact that it looks like smoking.
Let me introduce a point of view. I on a weird level, I'm excited about the idea. We talk about things that changed in this decade. Electronic cigarettes, I think we didn't even mention about that. The fact that people use electrical pens to smoke stuff to me is fascinating. And I like the idea of there's this alternative to smoking because smoking is very harmful, whatever. That, and so I don't have this sort of like, they should all be banished. But I am like, okay, let me not put myself all into team one, this is all good, or all in team two, this is all bad. I still want to look at that. Like, here's from the internet, questionable, an alleged CDC report that shows that, you know, in 2014, 10% of all high school kids had tried cigarettes, which has remained slightly declined. Now 20% of all high school kids have done e-cigarettes. Now, does try mean they picked it up or whatever? But we've seen this, the e-cigarette use is now far outpaced the use of cigarettes, as we're going on this trend line of fewer teenagers smoking. Now the number of teens trying e-cigs has actually passed the number of kids that ever smoked.
So here's the weird thing. I can say this and probably regret saying it out loud later. I believe all three of my children have tried e-cigarettes, and I'm the one that handed it to them. Because there is a magic trick created by our friend and friend of the show that uses an unflavored technology that makes it appear that comes out of nowhere. I won't say how the magic trick works, but do me a favor, just sign your name on that card so we recognize that card when we see it again. And somehow smoke comes out later. I don't feel one whiff bad about any of that. I don't know.
But that was that was a very controlled environment. It's not like you were having them do it to be like,
because it was cool.
Finish the oil cartridge.
I mean, they thought it was pretty cool. I thought it was cool.
This was students who tried with it within the last 30 days. The idea of like how, so it's some sort of idea of some theoretical implication of frequency. I have no horse in this race at all. I believe vaping is much safer than cigarettes, but I also believe that unintended consequences because of this theoretically safer. I do believe it's, I don't need to do quotes about it being theoretical. I think all the evidence shows it's safer than cigarettes. But because we've taken away, hey, the fear and the stigma, will more kids now pick it up?
I mean, it looks really cool.
It does. It does.
Doing it. Like the, no matter what, nothing will end with this until we find the safest way possible to look that cool.
I mean, also, how hard are we grasping to find, why, if theoretically it is 99% healthier, let's pick a number out of the air. If it's 99% healthier, I think everybody should vape.
Is it actually healthy? Because it is tobacco. It's still tobacco.
No, it's only the nicotine, because tobacco, it's the smoke and the additives, the chemicals, it's the burning particulates and all that stuff.
You're also taking a oily vapor into your lungs. We don't know the long-term effects of that. We just don't know.
Yeah.
It's worth saying. We know cigarettes are awful, so I don't think banning vaping is a really good idea when the alternative is cigarettes, but it's like marijuana research. Like, we haven't done a ton of longitudinal research into marijuana usage because that was almost effectively banned. We don't know. And we look more and like, oh yeah, young developing minds, I risk the ire of a lot of frequent marijuana users here, but hey, guess what? Everything has consequences.
That's the real bummer is of the 55 deaths attributed to vaping, almost all of them, the vast majority of them were THC, not nicotine. Second of all, they were almost all black market vapes, you know, some weird esoteric stuff cooked up. So weirdly by what, think about it this way. The decision to ban flavored vapes of all variety said, that's not enough black market operators. We need orders of magnitude more black market vapes out there. All vapes should be black market vapes.
Yeah, that's unintended consequences again. And I think we're all kind of, I think, of the camp, like, whatever you want to do, we don't care. It's cool. It's totally cool. We're all cool with that.
I think the one thing that was a bummer was as vaping kind of was on the rise, it felt from my vantage point, watching all my parental figures smoke growing up at a time where I remember being on a plane where you could smoke and smoking sections in restaurants being so permissive, even being an adult and living through the banning of smoking in bars and stuff like that, that vaping felt like in our modern age, technology has conquered a persistent ill, right? Let's remove much of what is bad about this, preserve what people enjoy, and move on. And now the hysteria around it, and you're right, Andrew, we don't know the long-term study. We don't know exactly how this affects people, but based on what we do know, it seems like a better...
I'm not talking about it as an alternative. And yes, absolutely. My point was, and again, I don't know if this facts are true, but when I looked at that CDC thing that Bryce put up there, twice as many kids now, you had 10% were smoking, now 20% are trying vaping, meaning that you have a whole sector that was never smoking that are now vaping. According to this, and I have, again, I'm just saying, by that point of view, you'd be like, well, yes, it's great if you're a smoker who switched. Do we need to double the number of people now smoking?
Yeah.
So that's it.
And good call. To bring it back to the very start of this conversation, like that's what makes the 21 year age, minimum age limit, whatever, feel super weird. Cause I think that's not going to do anything. It was already 18. That already wasn't going to stop high schoolers. And, I don't think that's a great reason to do 21. It feels like a very weird thing to champion, and I know the president was championing it as part of this other big spending deal before all the Iran stuff went on, I just look at it very confused as to what's up with it.
Yeah.
Yep. Oz.
I'm looking at the CDC site, which I'm glad that because there was a push prior to Big Tobacco getting involved in investing in e-cigarettes of this. Oh, these could be worse. We need to just outright ban it all. And that was scary because we've absolutely seen the reduction among the smoking population and the effects of people transitioning through there. And just the idea that the tobacco companies could have theoretically pushed through legislation and changed the government's point of view on it to the point that we could have banned it altogether and sent a lot of people to die without this alternative.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful that we're looking at it a little bit more pragmatically, which is good.
Yeah. So,
this segment brought to you by Juul.
It's super cool, but not till you're 21. So you just wait to be cool.
Yeah. You know, you're 20-year-old guys, you know, you look cool. You got to wait.
Yeah.
It does. It's like a public school assembly. Like, look, guys, man, I get it. People look so cool when they're having a Juul. You can see that they're relaxed. And I mean, I understand the temptation and those sweet, sweet flavors, that menthol. And there's sometimes you're just so stressed. You're like, oh, I just want to take a deep draw of a Juul. But you mustn't. You mustn't, man.
It was like those DARE assemblies where they'd get like the coolest person you'd seen is to a teenager say, oh yeah, I did everything. And you don't want to do that, kids. You know, and you're backstage in a rock concert doing blow, and you wake up the next day in another city with a bunch of people you don't know. You're like, tell me more.
Right?
Brian and I did a commentary track to that cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue, which I remember vividly as a child, which, like, when you watch it back, you're like, this is a advertisement for drugs. Like,
right?
It is nothing but all of your favorite cartoon characters going through stylized, over-the-top versions of being, in an altered state. And then at the very end, there's like 5 minutes where our main character's like, oh no, this is what I'd look like on drugs. And he's like a horrible ghoul. And then it's like, oh no, don't worry, we made you better again. It's like, so not only have you just made me watch the Ninja Turtles do LSD and Bugs Bunny do coke, but then at the end, you're like, I'm awful. No, don't worry. All of these effects are totally reversible in 5 minutes. You believe enough.
Just go on the trip, have the journey, and then just decide to put it behind you and shrug and become president.
God, it is. There is just a general... That would be like a great 15-minute YouTube video about like all PSAs are awful. Like
really any
PSA that warns you against vice is actively creating more of a market and desire for vice.
Yeah. Not gonna do it, guys. You're not gonna make me try it. Sorry.
The only vice advertisements that I think are effective are like gambling ones. Because they're almost always just they're just on everything for a gambling anything. It's just like, have a problem with gambling, call this number. Like, just that. There's no large, like, I'm up, baby! Life's great! Look at all this money! Oh, no! My house! I defaulted on my mortgage! But, like, you know, there's no narrative story to it. It's just like, do you got a problem? Call a number.
Yeah, they succeeded in making gambling addiction boring and embarrassing, and they treated it like it's a boring, embarrassing ailment, which it should be, because then you could call that number and not have it be a whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the government or the state governments spend tons of money buying billboards in poor neighborhoods for the lottery, but that's totally different.
I mean, there is that. Yeah, there is. You know, our state. Run gambling
activities. Gentlemen, want to do picks?
Yeah. My pick is pick six, the scratch off ticket. That is a lot of fun. No.
Brian loves interceptions.
Look at football, Bryce. Hey.
Free vape pen with every 10 purchases.
I'm listening to The Crucible. I reread the Coddling of the American Mind by Jonathan Haidt, and he was talking about how witch hunts happen, and almost universally witch hunts happen when almost everybody's on the same page, and they're almost always seemingly overnight, and they're almost always over a trivial infraction. And you can think of, you know, various things in academia. There's various stories, you know, the Red Scare and, of course, the Salem witch trial. And the Crucible does a good job of showing that story. I think the version I got had Stacey Keach and Richard Dreyfuss in it. But that's on Audible. And my pick is The Crucible.
I remember reading that years ago. I'm just going to say one thing. Which is not real, Red Scare, overblown, terrifying, but there really were active people trying to, from Soviet influence, whatever, and that's more and more we were sort of gaslighted into thinking there was nothing going on, and now when we opened up the Soviet archives, we found like, oh yeah, no, we funded this group, these screenwriters, all this, that was legit, and you're like, holy cow, you know, but
I'm going to guess that they don't add to that, and it was all foiled thanks to that, you know, those Senate hearings.
Well, I mean, that's just it. Is that's the problem? Is it like the overreaction can be just as bad or worse? But the idea that we kind of have been gaslighted and being told like, oh no, that never happened. And it's like Dalton Trumbo, great screenwriter. But you remember these are people telling us like, oh, the Soviets are the flip and flop versus, you know, no, the Nazis are okay because they're friends with the Soviets, and then no, the Nazis are now bad. And that's a thing that sort of got sort of pushed down the memory hole of that. But yes, Crucible is still a great story and really great, but that is, I'll find the name of the book. There's a really good book that went back and looked at the Soviet archives and found out like how pervasive it was and probably the problems that was caused by, you know, McCarthy using this as a way to go after political enemies, as opposed to legitimately, let's find out if there's what the influences are, and probably did more damage when there really were, you know, the active influence.
Hey, I got a pick. It's a little documentary miniseries on Netflix.com called Don't F Word with Cats.
What?
Oh, do you know anything about this? Before I pull this up, have you heard about this?
No, I know nothing about it.
Andrew, have you heard about this?
No.
Well, think when Justin tells you about it. Think if you heard this, if you actually heard of the story when it came out in real time.
So
wait, is this about the failure of Cats at the box office because they made him too sexy and it was creepy?
No,
is that what the don't F word part means?
I didn't click through to see what it was.
So I didn't really know what it was either. And it's really only once you click through it that you see its subtitle, The Hunt for an Internet Killer.
Okay.
The first half of this movie is...
I just read the headline there. Ugh.
Yeah, it's about a bunch of folks online, and the main characters are a woman who works in computers in Vegas and another dude who's also gets involved in this Facebook group that lives in L.A. But they become disgusted by this video that comes up of a guy murdering two little kittens. Right. It's a story that continues to move on and on. It is a gruesome murder story, as we find out eventually. But the access point and really the narrative drive of the story is from the point of view of the people that just get involved as citizens onto this Facebook group and just try to figure out who this person is and where this video took place. I've got some real problems with it. And I specifically at the end, I'm going to spoil the end because morally I feel like I have justification. The end has this very weird moment where both the two documentary subjects, the folks who initially just came onto the Facebook group to figure stuff out, start to wrestle with how much they were the cause of effectively a murderer. Who wound up becoming an international story, how much they fed into his attention. And then looking dead into the camera, they ask you, the viewer, how much you have, you know, culpability for watching a documentary about them being interested in and giving this person attention because the guy's still alive and blah, blah, blah. I found that to be really distasteful, considering that it's not called A Story of a Murderer. It's called Don't F with Cats, because that's the window into it. But that being said, it's a well-done documentary up until that. And although I have some other moments where it just made me very uncomfortable, specifically where they make or they ask, I guess, this woman to watch very graphic, very disgusting videos as she's describing them. I understand it, but man, did it escalate to places that I was not prepared for.
Yeah. Just a little Wikipedia in this, like, cats ain't the only thing he killed.
No. This becomes a large story. Some people might be aware of it because it certainly was in like the 2010, 2013 region.
What's funny is I remember the cat. I don't know that I actually watched the video, but I do remember the spread of there's this guy posting videos of him killing cats, and had not known about the follow up of him actually committing human style murder, home styled human murder.
Yeah, and look, this guy's a piece of work. He is everything that you want in a true crime story. He is a serial killer. He is vain. He is a lunatic. You know, the movie really, or the show, it certainly is captivating. But I will say this: the stuff that captivated me the most, and the story that I think this gets about a third of the way into telling, and then spins off into a far more traditional true crime story, is the "we're gonna solve the whole like we did it" Reddit, "we're gonna solve the crime here on this message board," which is a very internet emotion. It has very screwed up consequences when you realize that there are guidelines for journalists or for police detectives. There are reasons why investigations move at certain paces. There is a skill level to it. But yet everybody wants to solve the crime. Everybody wants to right injustice. And I think it gets really into it and does a very artful job of describing the ups and downs of what those situations kind of feel like. And then it just goes into some weird directions. But if that interests you, certainly the first episode is worth watching.
I smell a theme. Okay, what are your mob rule related picks?
I don't have a mob related pick. Maybe, I don't know, because some people think it's kind of culty. I got an Apple Watch Series 3 for Christmas, and I really dig this. I mostly wanted it for fitness tracking stuff, so when I go to the gym, or when I do the little fitness the Switch Ring Fit fitness exercise game that I've got, that I can actually count calories and not the very wrong number that the video game tells me. I think it's really cool. It's got a bunch of workouts programmed into it. It works with all the Nike stuff and some of the weight training stuff that I use. And actually, I think the most effective thing has been the rings thing, their idea of the three rings, close your rings.
Right.
Where
you find yourself jogging in place just before bed just to close the ring.
Just like a little bit. It's gotten me... one thing I was doing if I couldn't go and say exercise at the gym for the day was I would just go out on a walk. But for the exercise ring, it only counts the time if you are at a brisk walk heart rate. So you can't just walk for 2 hours and have that count. You have to kind of
it knows what heart zone you're at and whether or not you're actually achieving anything.
And so that's been pretty cool. And I, you know, the three is a few years old now. Oh, it's telling me it's time to stand. The three is a few years old now, but it works really well. It still works really well. I haven't had really any issues with apps being slow. I find that some of the it's nice to see some of the notifications on my wrist. A lot of them I don't need. I don't need to know that the New York Times crossword puzzle is now available to play. That doesn't really help me any. Even some of the audio apps just don't even seem to be as functional as the built-in Now Playing app that kind of mimics the Control Center one on the iPhone.
Yeah, that really changed the game when they made that the default, that as you were playing something, it would have very functional controls. My thing from the very beginning with the Apple Watch is, if you're interested in one, understand how much you're interacting with your home screen. Mm-hmm. And even if your home screen is too busy, then take that time, especially now with iOS, it makes it really easy to manage your notifications. Clean that up, because that is all going to be on your watch and you're just going to be weird and distracted about it. But
yeah,
the tracking's interesting.
Yeah. The thing that Just to bounce off of what Justin said really quick, like the thing that I've had to spend these 2 weeks learning is like what is really most helpful to be on the watch face that I use and why, what different faces should have different uses. Because it takes a minute to realize, oh, I tend to need these things rather than it's nice to see this on a screen.
I got the 3-2 a few weeks ago. Not wearing it because I have cleaned up a ton of the notifications on my phone, and I don't know what I did wrong or what happened, but at some point all these stupid notifications started popping up on my watch, right? And Apple News, like, yeah, I'm going to go read Apple News. Yeah, all this sort of stuff started coming up, and the thing that I hate most is having these things come in, and I know there's a setting somewhere. I know there is, but my default on my phone was to not have these notifications. And then I went in and like, oh, all these apps have had the notifications turned on. I'm like, I never said do that. And that again, I'm sure the fault is mine, but I'm like, I just threw it on the counter. I was done with it. I just sort of like it did the thing I did not want it to do. My girlfriend, I got her the Fitbit Versa 2, which the nice thing about that is it's like, how long does the battery last? Like a week's worth of battery, and it helps with the sleep tracking, Cool. And that's been. And I think that if you want a lower impact thing, I think the Apple Watch is great. It's got an amazing number of features and stuff like that. But if you want some like a simpler one, but also does sleep tracking and all that, I think the Fitbit Versa 2 is another good alternative. Like
I'll say the battery life that I've had on the 3, now granted it's a 3, it's not the new 5 that has, I guess, the even better battery life, but it also has the always on screen. I probably, if I just wanted to charge it at a different time of the day, probably could use it for sleep tracking. And
well, the Fitbit does like a week before charging.
I know, but I was, right. I was preemptively, I was wondering if Brian, because I know your thing against the Apple Watch is that it doesn't last long enough to really do good sleep tracking.
Correct. And I deeply value the sleep tracking stuff. And I don't doubt that maybe a generation or two from now, there'll probably be some version, maybe as you know, for all we know. Next year, they'll have an e-ink version that doesn't quite play video, but lasts, battery goes for a month or whatever,
I'm just saying, if you do want to do that, I don't think it's a total no-sell on this. I think it is very possible, but that would just mean having it off at a different time of the day and charging it then. Yeah. And then that gets to be weird, like when, if you're doing the exercise stuff, then that's X amount of hours that you don't have it on. So I don't know. I think the battery life surprised me more than I thought it would. Though I have a sense that it's probably draining my phone battery more.
I also don't like always on. If the difference is I get a 2 days worth of battery versus it being always on, especially at like, a theater or a dark area where I'm glowing, then I don't know. I mean, I think I have a 3, so I think I have the same one that you do, Bryce, but,
the 5 came out this year. I haven't really looked into it. I wonder if you can turn the always on off, because that would be a significant battery life increase. And they've got the theater mode on it so that it doesn't automatically just
I'm not going in there and flipping.
It's on the thing. It's very, I could show you after. It's very easy. I use it all the time.
I know where it is, but like now I gotta remember it, and somebody's looking over, and next thing you know it's a now I'm getting into a fight at,
anyway, Apple Watch Series 3. I think it's cool, and it seems like an okay price for a fitness thing.
Hey, quick, as long as we're doing consumer goods, I'll throw in an extra tip of the hat to late for Christmas. Finally, it arrived, but I gave my wife this Ember mug. Have you guys seen this? It is a smart mug.
I've heard of these.
Oh, wait, Justin, what's that in your hand, sir?
Why, friend, it's my Ember mug.
Are you loving it?
I've had it for about a year. Ashley got it for me for Christmas last year. But yeah, we both have one. It keeps your coffee hot. The battery life ain't great, I'll tell you that. But it is certainly cool. And I know a friend of ours had actually been doing some like really like pushing it to the limit. Like he was like making ramen and stuff in it. It is a very cool device.
So explain to this ignorant here what the Ember mug is?
It's got a puck that it sits on, and there's a couple of electrical points of contact that charge the mug, and then the mug has a battery in it, and you just sort of decide how hot you want it to be, and then your stuff just stays hot.
Okay.
Your fully charged mug.
Interesting.
I live with a coffee drinker who is standing 3 feet away from me now with this excited look on her face. She bolted up from her workstation and just stood here like, what is this magical technology?
Does it? So you mentioned that it's smart. Does it do like any sort of hydration tracking stuff? I know there are some weird ideas for smart
drinks. I think basically you just decide how hot you want on the app. And okay. Then that's just how hot it keeps it.
But also it is, so it's tied to an app, so you can pour your coffee and it will alert you when it has reached your desired temperature.
Oh, I see. That's clever.
Okay. Yeah.
It's so funny. It's like Andrew is getting to see the face of somebody who just saw a new PlayStation announced. You know.
Too bad Christmas passed. You got your Fitbit.
Andrew, you got a pick?
I do, and it's actually going to be a repeat of a pick. But first, Bryce, shame. Justin, shame. Brian, shame.
I've been shamed.
Any of you watch season one of The Terror?
Wait, what?
Any of you watch season one of The Terror?
Oh, no. This is the based on a true story thing?
They take the account of the I've mentioned this before, The Terror and the Erebus, which were these British sailing ships on an expedition to find the Northwest Passage in the early part of the 19th century. And it's got, you know, a wonderful, wonderful cast. And it's a fictionalized, you know, supernatural horror sort of story thing, but you told in a world where, you know, one day you're out at sea and then your ship at night, next thing you know, you're iced in completely in what was now ocean of solid ice, and you're stranded there for years. And which is true, which is what happened to that. But then this based on the novel by Dan Simmons, who is a great writer, but the story, I enjoyed it. Anthology series, season two is totally different. I haven't seen this yet, which is about a Japanese internment camp. Season one, though, is just taking that mission and doing a self-contained, like 10-episode, 8-episode story. I really enjoyed it. I'm not saying, oh, guys, this is the greatest thing on TV ever, but for a really tight...
You did shame all three of us.
What's that?
You did shame all three of us, but...
Yes. Did anybody see it?
No, but no. Okay.
So what's your point, Bryce? Do you not deserve any shame? No, I think you dig it. I don't want to try to overpraise it, but it's just a solid, I really enjoyed this. I enjoyed where this went and taking what we know about what really happened and telling a cool story. I really liked it.
That dude did Hyperion, Dan Simmons.
Yeah. Yeah, that Dan Simmons. He wrote this.
Oh, well, that's cool. I loved Hyperion.
Yeah.
There we go. Is it streaming? Where are you watching it streaming? Are you buying it?
I was watching it on Hulu.
On Hulu. All right. Very cool.
Yeah, I haven't seen season two, and I've heard really mixed things about that. But again, it's totally different story in season two. So it's one of these things, like, any of you guys watch Castle Rock yet?
No. I hear great things about
episodes.
It.
Shame! Shame! this is... Castle Rock is great because it's another... Hey, we're going to do 10 episodes in this season, and you're going to get a complete story, and then the second season's going to be different. These anthology series things, I never really dug American Horror Story that much because it was just too campy for me, where Castle Rock season one, I really dug. It was probably one of my favorite, if you ask me to list some of my favorite shows that I've seen on streaming, new media, whatever. That was one that was actually produced by Hulu. The Terror is AMC, but it was on Hulu. I really liked it. Again, I don't want to overpraise it, but it's really just you take British sailing vessel stories combined with horror, Inuit mythology, and real things that took place. And I more I want to tell you, but I don't want to ruin anything.
Very cool.
Yeah. Somebody said, Jake Calhoun says they watched two episodes of Castle Rock. Castle Rock, if you follow that thing through, it's really good. And season two was fun. I didn't like it as much as season one, but I still really liked it. I still really enjoyed it. So, all right. There. The public shaming has come to a complete.
Oh, good. So yeah, I know you only did the shame thing to tie it together with the whole witch hunt mentality. That's fine. It's fine.
Exactly. Oh, you're on a list, Brian. You're on a list. Yeah, I'll give you guys up in a heartbeat. You know that. Anyhow, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this broadcast.